I had a pretty much very difficult childhood. My father was a habitual gambler. My parents actually divorced. She had to shrimp and save every single dollar through the years. And I think that toughest bit of my childhood just formed that core part of who I am as a person. So when I actually started my banking career, all I did was just try to earn a lot of money. And actually, so I could spend it and get those experiences, because I had never been able to have those experiences when I was much younger. And as a result, I had very few savings. But then came a near-death accident, which almost happened about almost 10 years ago. This very young version of me was just having too much drinks at a beach club in Singapore. And there was a very shallow swimming pool. And very clearly intoxicated, I decided to do a somersault into the very shallow swimming pool. That's when my head actually hit the bottom of the swimming pool. The doctors were telling me that 99% of those who get this would have died. And 99% of them who didn't get it would have been paralyzed or some form or another. So to me, I was really just a very lucky person to just survive, right? And I think that really was a very major turning point overall in my life. I very soon came to the realization that I needed to have purpose and leave behind a positive impact. My life mission is actually to excite, to inspire, and to empower people to pursue their dreams and to grow their businesses to create long-term, sustainable, positive value by making the world and mankind a better future.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. My guest today is Eugene Ng. But before I introduce Eugene, I wanted to mention some countries that my listeners are from. The majority of listeners are in the United States, and most of them in major states, as you can guess. But some of the countries on the list that have fewer than 1% of listeners are Oman, North Macedonia, Bermuda, Lebanon, and Malawi. And I'll mention some countries in the coming weeks. But if you're from any of those countries, I'd be curious to hear from you. Let me know why you're interested in the podcast, what do you like about it, and you can find a way to contact me on my website. And I'll mention some states that ended up on the list as well. And here I have Montana, Mississippi, and West Virginia. So if you're from those states and would like to get in touch, find a way on the website and send me a quick email as well. All right. And my guest today, Eugene Ng. Eugene is a Singapore-based investor, the founder and chief investment officer of Vision Capital and Vision Capital Ventures. He's also an author of the Amazon best-selling book, Vision Investing: How Do We Beat Wall Street? And you can too. He also teaches investing once a year to educate new investors and to give back. Vision Capital invests only in publicly traded companies that reflect the best vision for our future, changing and shaping the world for the better. Eugene was born and raised in Singapore, studied economics and finance, and received a summa cum laude from the Singapore Management University in 2008. Eugene is also a keen sportsman, and he represented the Singapore national team in water polo in 2007 Southeast Asian Games, winning their 22nd consecutive team gold. Eugene's career in finance spans over 11 years. He started in 2008, joining Citi as a management associate for 3 years, followed by JP Morgan, where he provided FX and interest rate sales and advisory for corporates, where he was a vice president. Eugene and I recorded the episode before Buffett's Berkshire meeting in Omaha in May. I had the pleasure of seeing him in person at the event and talking to him more. His passion for investing and his curiosity beams through in this recording as much as it did when we met in person. Today, Eugene shares with us stories from his childhood and young adulthood. We go on a roller coaster ride from growing up with no money and a parent with a gambling addiction to a near-death experience to discovering his ikigai, his true reason for being. We discuss stock investing and how it can be a path to wealth. We discover how long-term investing works best. Eugene shares his thoughts on the futility of market timing. We learn about various types of companies that he likes and why it pays to never sell entirely your position. You'll find a lesser-known story about Steve Jobs towards the end of the episode too. Please help me welcome Eugene Ng.
I also wanted to share with you that my book, Crisis Investing, 100 Essays, reached a top 1, 2, 3 position in some major categories in Amazon's new releases in finance, investing, stock investing, and portfolio management in the last few days. So thank you for that. The book is available on Amazon, and the Kindle version is still selling for only 99 cents. If you like it and enjoy it, please write me a quick review. The early reviews matter, so I appreciate it. Thank you, and let's get going with the show. Eugene, welcome to the show. I've been looking forward to this conversation. How are you?
Good morning to you, Bogum. It's delightful, and thank you for getting me on the show.
Well, I read your book, Vision Investing, How We Beat Wall Street, and You Can Too. And I was just telling you what a wonderful book it is. It's very intimate. It's a very personal story, and it's very well researched as well. You make a big argument in favor of investing, a very particular style of investing that I'll ask you about in a minute. But before we get there, I want to hear about you. And as you may know, I like to ask my guests about the very beginning, about your childhood and upbringing and how that time of your life might have influenced your interest in money and investing. In the book, you say how having no money or little money teaches you things, teaches you certain lessons. Let's start from the beginning. Tell me about those early days of Eugene.
I think the way to start off with is really, I had a pretty much very difficult childhood. I was very fortunate to be born and raised in Singapore, which is in Asia, with a younger brother to two lovely middle-income parents. But in my early teenage years, life was not really the easiest. My dad or my father was a habitual gambler, often was drinking and was smoking a lot, and he came back home drunk most of the time. And of which, those gambling actually left my mom with very huge gambling debts to repay. So that at that point of time, just to give an example, the debts were almost $20,000 and my mom was earning almost only a monthly income of $2,000. So that's how huge relative to how much she was earning was. After getting it twice and he still went back to gamble, my parents actually divorced not long after. So my mom took sole custody of both me and my younger brother and I, and she had to shrimp and save every single dollar through the years. And for a large part of her life, she was actually eating a lot of bread just to bring both me and my younger brother. More, very importantly is that she actually managed to borrow a lot of money from her relatives and friends. And she paid back every single cent with interest as well. And I think to me, the value of money and the managing of it was very important, because to me, it was a belief that I would never want to go through what my mother ever gone through again. She went through so much just to bring both me and my brother up single-handedly, and just to pay off the debts earlier and faster. And I think that toughest bit of my childhood just formed that core part of who I am as a person. And the way to think about it next is actually thinking about money as a central theme. I learned to value the importance of having money, and I was also not having it. I think money initially had a lot of negative connotations, as you can imagine, right? People who were rich couldn't come along with us, and also gambling and all. So when I actually started my banking career, all I did was just try to earn a lot of money, and actually so I could spend it and get those experiences, because I had never been able to have those experiences when I was much younger. And as a result, I had very few savings. But then came a near-death accident, which almost happened about almost 10 years ago. This very young and brash version of me was just having too much drinks at a beach club in Singapore. And there was a very shallow swimming pool, and very clearly intoxicated, I decided to do a somersault into the very shallow swimming pool. That's when my head actually hit the bottom of the swimming pool. The top of my neck, my C1, just actually broke into two pieces, and the back actually joined. The front is still open. Mm. And that's when I actually wore a halo vest, where I had four scars drilled into my skull to keep my neck in place such that the bones can really recover. That was a very painful, and how serious this was, the doctors were telling me that 99% of those who get this would have died, and 99% of them who didn't get it would have been paralyzed in some form or another. So to me, I was really just a very lucky person to just survive, right? And I think that really was a very major turning point overall in my life. And I think the way to come back full circle was really try to reset my money beliefs. And the best thing was that thankfully I really didn't lose my life and got paralyzed, but I wanted to rethink about my life and what I wanted to do. And my wife gave me a bit of a nudging. You don't want to go back to what you were, just spending lots of money, right? And so what I did was I attended two very important seminars back then. The first one was actually T. Harv Eker's Millionaire Mind Intensive and Tony Robbins' Unleash the Power Within. That was so powerful because it just got a permanent reset of how I thought about money. And the most important concepts that I took away from that was that money really symbolizes long-term value creation. I never thought about it that way, and it's just so simple. So to give an example, right? One would have earned money because one was actually providing a higher value creation through the services that it provided or the products that they sold. That's simple. And in return, you are spending money on someone else doing exactly the same, right? So it's an exchange of value creation. So the best thing is that if you actually do it well and you do it right, you can actually make a lot of money over the very long run. So what I realized is that having money coincided with providing value. And when you got that right, that was like, okay, wow, I never thought about it. I thought the rich would just gather the material possessions and that's it, right? But after a while, you started thinking, right, what happens is that I fast forward my life into the decades, 40, 50 years later, and I'm older. If I was rich and I just had a lot of lots of material possessions, right? Eventually what happens? I bring nothing to the grave, right? So that got me really thinking about, okay, what then do I need to do? And I very soon came to the realization that I needed to have purpose and leave behind a positive impact that was really helping and impacting more people positively with what I could. So all I thought was, if I could just help a few people in my life, in this entire lifetime, and they could lead better life, and they could lead through generations, that was all that mattered. And to me, that was just that whole big shift, right? And I think that the last bit of it, I only want to go think about it, is really the true joy in life, right? Coming from purpose and positive impact, right? One of my favorite quotes that from George Bernard Shaw, he writes, I'm gonna just take paraphrase and take the most important words, is that I want to be the true joy in life, being used for a purpose that is recognized by yourself as a mighty one, being this force of nature, and my life belongs to the whole community. And as long as I live, it is my privilege to do for it what I can. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die. The harder I work, the more I live. I rejoice in life for its own sake. Life is a splendid torch, which I have got hold of it for the moment, and where I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations. This paragraph really sums back that whole entire full circle of how I thought about money, coming back to purpose, coming back to leaving that positive impact. And I think that's really how that just sparked that so incremental shift overall and got me to also writing that book.
No, that's beautifully said. And the idea of rethinking your beliefs at some point, and those beliefs get formed very early on in our lives and we might not be aware of them, and just pausing for a minute and seeing which ones benefit us, which ones don't. And I see it over and over again in investors' life. But speaking of investing, you chose that out of all pursuits that were in front of you, you chose investing. And I'll ask you more why stock investing in a second. But first of all, why investing? Why that path?
When it came back down to purpose, right, I think I was doing this particular day and I had of when I was doing TRF Eckers and I signed up for Quantum Leap, there was this particular course where we actually spent 3 days writing our life mission. And to me, what I realized in the life mission was this. So my life mission is actually to excite, to inspire and to empower people to pursue their dreams and to grow their businesses to create long-term, sustainable, positive value by making the world and mankind a better future. It's a very meaningful life mission to me. And when that came back down to me, I realized, okay, I'm actually pretty good at numbers. I'm pretty good at understanding businesses as something that equity research was something that I was always passionately interested in during back in school and everything. Why not investing? So I think when I started coming and learning about investing, I realized the most beautiful thing is reading about businesses and people who create them, managing and growing them. I think it's really about understanding how, going back to what I said, right, how they provide value. And then they themselves make money and profits by capturing a percentage of that value creation. And if that can be so right. scalable and can be continuously sustained over a long period of time, that is just like the best kind of companies. And for me, also, I also do love reading annual reports and just trying to figure out if a company is worth investing in, if it is truly durable, can it continue to sell and service its customers, continue to delight them and make them happy. I think those are the ways investing really got back to me. So if I can think about it, really gelling it back in, it's really my ikigai, right? And the Japanese word of my ikigai, I guess the way you can think about it is what I love, which is investing, which I just shared. I think it's what I'm good at, what the world needs, and what I can be paid for, right? So if I come back to what I'm good at, I think for me, it was a long period and I tried to spend many years trying to figure out what are the drivers of stock market returns over the long run. That as investors, we just need to embrace all these short-term fluctuations as opportunities. And I think very important to figure out that just try to learn from the greatest investors out there. I think for me, most investors just don't outperform and beat the market. And I believe that through a consistent and very thoughtful framework and investing philosophy that is data-backed, so you can see from my book, that one can beat the market. And I think that over the long term, this is the only term that counts, right? So I think it's something that I'm good at. What the world needs, I think, is very important because people want them to help them to grow their savings and wealth over long periods of time. Startups and businesses, again, want capital to grow and to deliver and to create value, right? If I can help more people to grow their wealth, I can also impact the knowledge by through sharing and teaching or by even doing it for them, right? Or by giving capital to the right businesses, startups. This can be such a powerful flywheel because this is what the world truly needs and hopefully what I can be paid. So thankfully, I've been rewarded with a growing portfolio of businesses that keep growing and compounding and creating value. I do look forward at the time to become long-term stewards of other people's savings. I think that will be truly the life I would want to live in day in and day out, which is, I'm sure that's what you do too, Bogomil. But I think that's truly the dream for me.
I think one of the revelations that a lot of investors have is that managing your own money, then managing your family money, and then managing other people's money can be different things, right? If it's just you, you are answering to the person in the mirror. If it's your family money, then you're answering to quite a few people at some point, maybe. And when it's other people's money, you take on their emotions, their anxieties, their fears. And it becomes a whole different experience. It's not just managing your own emotional discipline. And you touched on something interesting. I was asked at Columbia University recently, where I was giving a talk at their business school, about technology, how technology is changing our business. And I see technology as a tool that helps me get more productive, get things done, or look things up and so on. And I think there's some amazing tools that appeared in the last 2 decades that I've been doing this. But at the end of the day, it's a people's business. On one side, you have clients and you are a steward of their capital, of their life savings, of their inheritance, of everything they might ever have in their life. So it's a huge responsibility. On the other side, you turn around and you pay that capital to people that are managing businesses. And hopefully they're managing in a way that grows the value and the size and the reach of those businesses. And they do it in a way that you feel comfortable with. And I always say that at the end of the day, the best test is the quality of sleep. Can I sleep well? And can my clients sleep well? So some investment opportunities or alleged investment opportunities are outside of my reach because they wouldn't let me or my clients sleep well. But all this to say, it's a people's business. You make an interesting argument in your book that I agree with in favor of stock investing specifically. And you quote some studies, Credit Suisse, one of them. And then you also quote another study that makes an argument in favor of US equities specifically. That comes from some study done by Lauren Templeton, or shared by Lauren Templeton, who was also a guest on this podcast. Tell me more about those two studies. I believe they both cover 120 years and they show how you can grow your money successfully. Historically, we were able to, both in stocks and specifically in US stocks. Can you talk more about it?
I think the way when I started out thinking about investing is trying to figure out, is it a short game or is it a long game? All the way to do it, right? And try to figure out how to make money. And I think the first biggest chart and I realized is one of my favorite quote by David Gardner, which is stocks go up over the long run from left to right, but they can go down faster. and quick yield in the very short run, right? And upon realizing that, if you plot any stock chart, especially in the US, over the long run of any 30, 40, 50 years, it's always from bottom left to top right. And coming to realize that, okay, that's the good thing. So now how can I figure out how to do this? And I wanted to make sure that if I'm choosing across many different financial assets, which is available to us, which is the one that makes the most sense, right? So I started looking at stocks, bonds, commodities, cash, oil, gold, and everything, right? So started looking and comparing, and I think this is a very consistent. If you look at stocks, the reason why stocks have beaten bonds and cash over the long term, despite just massive business cycles, right? 10, 5, 10, 20 years, even though we can argue that business cycles have gotten a little bit more shorter the last couple of years. But I think the main reason is this, and it's the most powerful, why stocks actually outperform bonds. Equities can compound in value in a way that investments in other asset class like bonds cannot, because businesses generate profits and they retain a portion of those profits to reinvest in the business. When you do that for bonds, that does not happen. And one, when a business can reinvest those profits at very high rates of return, and they can compound over long periods of time, growing very quickly, that's the difference why equities have over bonds outperform over the very, very long run. And this, with the power of compounding, that only gets bigger and more pronounced over time. It's a very unique property to bonds, to stocks, because stocks are actually just part ownership of businesses. And that's the power of true of businesses.
Let's pause here. That's a very powerful statement. And I mentioned that in many conversations that Peter Lynch, in his book, One Up on Wall Street, opened my eyes to the idea that stocks are small pieces of businesses. And it might sound so obvious to you and I today, but it wasn't obvious to me when I was 20. And I thought it's just a ticker with a price moving up and down, and it's a casino that nobody can win. And I realized, oh, I get to own a small piece of a business along with the founder. So it doesn't matter if I have $100, $1,000, and $10, or I have $1 billion. I'm participating proportionately to my investment in the success of the business. The one interesting point, you talk about bonds, and I think Buffett in his recent letter was comparing treasuries to Coca-Cola, an investment over 30 years in treasuries and Coca-Cola. And at the end of the day, if you buy a $1 million bond, you have $1 million plus whatever you collected in income throughout the time. But if you bought $1 million worth of Coca-Cola 30 years ago, that represented some 0.0 whatever percent of the company. You still own that company. And if they were doing share buybacks, probably you own a little bit more of that company. And it's a much bigger company. And Buffett has those stories that the dividends that he receives today from some of the investments he made are higher than the initial investment. When you think about it for a second, it's incredible the size of compounding that happened. And one last point I wanted to make about real estate, because some people get excited about real estate, and I have all respect for people that are experts in that field. But all I wanted to add is that if you buy a house on a street somewhere in a major city, after 100 years, you still own the same house on the same street, and hopefully it's as desirable as it was 100 years ago, which is not always the case. I lived in many cities, and I know how neighborhoods come and go, and some are less popular after a while, some are more popular. It's a big bet. But it's one single building that you still own. If you own a percent of a company, after 100 years or after 50 years, whatever, it's a much bigger pool of profit that you could potentially be an owner of. It doesn't compare with owning a building. I never really understood why people get so excited. Now, if you add leverage to real estate, and if you add the tax benefits, and if you buy something that's truly distressed and so on, yes, there are opportunities, but I think the context is really helpful to understand. So tell me, why U.S. equities? I think you're excited about U.S. equities. That's at least the message I found in your book. Tell me more about why, out of the entire world, and I agree with you there, but why U.S. equities?
It was a very interesting bit. So what happens is that I actually took a value investing course just about almost 7 years ago when I wanted to start investing and to really accelerate my learning. So I started to do very deep value investing, which is obviously echoing the fair bit of what Warren Buffett did. And a fair bit of, I think, in the investing course, it always tried to highlight very, I want companies that are growing their revenues. They also want companies who are very profitable. And when they gave me those matrix and I started screening across Asia, I realized most of the companies, or the very good companies in Asia, are growing low single digit top line. So you start realizing if they're growing low single digit top line, okay. And if their PE ratios are also maybe 10 to 15, which is not too expensive, not too cheap. And assuming if the P multiples stay the same, if the top line grows the same, the profit margins are already very high and can't improve further, profits are going to grow at the same pace, which is, let's say, low single digits. Mm-hmm. Your returns are going to be low single digits. Mm-hmm. So I went on the entire phase and screened through the whole of Asia, and I couldn't find, to be honest, a lot of companies that were worth investing in that aspect. And I started going to Asia, going to the US, and oh my mind, my mind was just blown. When I first came across Visa, MasterCard, Facebook, Google or Alphabet back then, I was just mind blown. Like, how could you have companies that could keep growing 20-30% over the very long run and was so much more profitable and had very large addressable markets, right? As they're almost global markets, right? Ex-China, of course. And I think that's the way. And I was just mind blown because the total addressable market is just significantly larger. The US is just a much larger population and of course, with employees. So I think the way to think about it, it's geographically also very different because if you look at Asia, they traditionally had been a lot more manufacturing based, electronics based as well. And I think if you look or banks or very old economy, whereas if you go to the US, they had been more technologically more advanced and obviously had moved a bit more up the chain, right? Because we are now in the fourth industrial revolution and we have to move closer to it, right? So I think that was some of the biggest revelations. I think it was not by design that I found US equities attractive. It was just by looking at all the companies and I was just more excited by that. And that's just by that nature. And it's no surprise, to be honest, why US equities have outperformed most asset classes and across most markets over the very long run as well.
That's the argument that I also make in my book, Money, Life, Family, how the US market, given the size, people forget how big of a market it is, the depth of it, the liquidity available, the appeal that companies see in being listed in the US, even foreign companies. So you have recent companies like Spotify that were not even started in the US, but end up being listed in the US and getting most of the access to capital in the US. And there are Australian and other companies that do it, and obviously Asian companies that do it. And what's interesting is that when you invest in the US, you get half of the profits on average. Just looking at the S&P 500, they're not even in the US. So you get access to the whole world. So people think, oh, you're just in one market. You're not. You're really in a global situation. The one thing that I grew to appreciate is in the US, if something works, they turn it into a concept that's tested across all states. And Peter Lynch, in his book, One Up on Wall Street, made that point. If a retail concept, well, these are the easiest to showcase. If it works in one state, how about we open it in multiple states? How about we open it in all states? How about we also open it in Canada? How about Mexico? And then 5 years down the road, something becomes a global chain or a global concept or a global brand. That's a benefit that very few companies outside of the US have, to be able to spread their brand and their product outside. There's some examples in Europe, there's some examples in Asia, but the US, if it works in the US, it will probably work outside of the US. And when you look at newer companies, you touched on it, they, even in the early days, even before they go public, they are usually already global companies. You mentioned Facebook, but I'm thinking Airbnb. Even before they listed for the first time and became available to the public shareholder, sometimes they have half of their business already outside of the US. And sometimes the profits, the margins are even better in some of the markets abroad. So that's something worth keeping in mind. And I'm glad you pointed that out and noticed it. I like your argument about long-term approach. And you make a point that the odds of success go up if you start to think long-term. You even say something really interesting to me. The price at which you bought was not important. How long you held it matters most. And a lot of investors, and especially those that consider themselves value oriented, are very price sensitive. Buffett has many stories of being so price sensitive that he almost didn't do something or did something he didn't want to do because of how price sensitive he used to be. I think he's less so today. And I think that's something that happens to all of us. But you say the price at the end is not as important, but the length, how long you held it, that matters the most. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I think in terms of price, right, I think the most important bit is a very good question. I think we hear a lot of investors that we should be investing for the long term. I get it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But for me, I really didn't get it. Why should we really invest for the long term, right? So I actually came across this chart that was done by Morgan Housel before Morgan Housel became Morgan Housel. He was actually working at the Motley Fool back then. So it was actually shared by Tom Gardner, which is the co-founder of the Motley Fool many years when he came to Singapore. So he did this study, which is provided by data, which is real market returns over 150 years, 150 years, right? What it shows very interesting is this. The odds of success, meaning percentage of periods that return a positive return for one day, is about 52%, which is just slightly better than a coin toss. And the reason why it's above 50% is because markets tend to trend up over the long run. So slightly better than a coin toss, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you increase that to 1 year, that percentage of success rises to 69%, close to 70%. When you increase that to 10 years, it goes to 88%. And when it goes to 20 years and more, as you can imagine, it becomes 100%. Now, if you are investing for the very short run, you're trying to buy and sell stocks, you're playing in a market in which your natural and your probability of odds of success is probably around 50% at best. But if you are playing for the investing in the long run, you're playing in a market where your odds of success is going to be significantly higher, right? 70, 80, 90%, 100% if you're finding the right companies.
Yeah.
So I think that significantly, if you just change your investment horizon just upfront from one of short-term being a trader to one of long-term, your odds of winning have just dramatically increased significantly. And I think many people don't actually realize this bit. And it's very important to just, okay, it's very good to just acknowledge and just invest long-term, but really understanding this math, and it's so simple, right? But we're really just understanding this and just trying to apply back, because the way you think about investing, as you mentioned just now, right, is really thinking about the odds, the mathematics, right, I think of really probabilities and outcome. Because firstly, one, in investing, it's just not definite. You can't think of specific numbers and outcomes. What we're trying really here to do is to firstly increase the probabilities of odds of winning,
right,
of success, right? And then when they win, we want to increase the amount of payoffs. So I think that's really the way I think about investing. So if you do it right, and going back to the long term, right, if you find winners that do it very well and they tend to be multi-baggers, so meaning companies that can return 5-4, 10-4, 20-4, 50, even 54, 100-4, your original capital that you put it in. But the most important thing is you read in like the book of 100 baggers, right? It takes time. It takes a long time, right? Most of them tend to take anywhere from 10, 15, 20 years or so. So if you do that, what happens is that the gains from these multi-baggers will significantly outweigh all of the losses of all your losers combined, many folds over. And if you do that right, your portfolio returns actually almost become like very power law driven, where such a small minority of very large winners come to dominate the entire portfolio. This is something that I had hypothesized when I wrote the book and actually drew a graph of the picture, which you can see, which you have seen. But I've actually come to realize and actually experienced that firsthand over the last 3 years or so in my own personal portfolio. So I think that's something that has been increasingly important. And when, like, for example, I think my last portfolio was like 20% of the winners actually accounted for almost 80% of the gains. And that's really what it was. And I think the most important thing is the winners just become very significant. The losers just become irrelevant. And somehow, you don't... And I think most importantly, we want to just remove anything that just permanently kicks us out of the investing game, right? You want to avoid anything that is basically gives you unlimited downside payoffs at all costs, which is why, for example, we don't take any margin. Or because if you take any margin, if there are any declines, the declines will force you to sell your position. You might have experienced that loss. Or if you sell short, for example, you have unlimited downside, or you short any options. So I think the way thing is really thinking about investing, getting the probabilities right, getting the payoff right when you get those right, and removing anything that removes all significant unlimited downside, just position yourself to allow you to invest in the long term, where that probabilities of getting it right just swings in your favor, and somehow outperformance in Alpha Gems just comes naturally from the overall standpoint. And all now you need to do is try to identify which other companies that fit in that portfolio.
You touched on so many interesting points. So let's start from the end of what you said. So I have a no-zero policy. So it means I'm not going to buy anything that I can imagine going to zero from day one. And it eliminates a lot of investments, and I'm fine with that. So that's one thing. You talk about unlimited downside, you know, margins or derivatives. That's completely outside of my area of interest. I don't want to play in that part of the sandbox. But that's really interesting, and it's very important to understand, especially if you want to stay in the investment game for the long run. I think that's very important. Morgan Housel, great guy. I had coffee with him in New York years ago, and I highly recommend his book, Psychology of Money. I think it's very accessible and fun to read, and I think every time I go back to it, I find something else. And he's a wonderful writer. I think he has a way of presenting not very easy ideas, but in a way that's digestible and fun. Now, you mentioned the multi-baggers and Chris Mayer. with his book, 100 Baggers, was on the show. And we talked about the coffee can portfolio. If you listen to the episode, and if you know the story, it's fascinating what happens. And it's one of the questions I had for you, because you quote a study how the majority of your portfolio returns will come from very few stocks, which you just touched on. But it's very interesting to see what happens. And Buffett, in a recent letter in 2023, the letter from last year, he wrote how when you compare the treasuries and Coca-Cola, treasuries after 30 years become a small part of the portfolio and the winning position becomes a big part of the portfolio. If you think about it for a second, even if you bought the things that have not performed as well as you thought, they will represent a smaller and smaller part of the portfolio. And the winners, if you let them stay, which is back to your earlier point, how long you hold it matters, they will run and represent a bigger and bigger part of the portfolio. It will be a strange portfolio to look at because you might have a big part of the portfolio in one position, but it will really make a difference. Now, that's managing your own money, managing other people's money, and explaining why 20% or 40% of the portfolio is in a single stock. That's a whole different experience and probably a topic for another podcast episode. But let's go back to this idea that the majority of the portfolio returns comes from very few stocks. And you quote a study from Henrik Essenbinder. Do stocks outperform treasury bills? Tell me more about that study and how that influenced your thinking about your stock picks.
This was a very important study because I came across this study before I even came across Power Laws by Peter Thiel. So this was a stunning revelation. So this study was done looking at the US stock market from 1926 to 2016. And what we did was they analyzed about 25,000 or so companies that existed at some point of time during this entire period. They found two very most important observations. And these were the two observations. It's that first one, only about 4% of that whole entire lot of companies, which is about 1,000 companies, were responsible for the entire returns of the stock market, of which 0.4%, so 1/10 of that 4%, about 90 companies were responsible for more than half of the returns of the stock market. This was a very, and the remaining 96% basically of the 24,000 companies had zero to negative returns.
Incredible.
What it tells you that is that basically the majority of the companies that are being listed out there are not worth investing in. Power laws really drive even public markets when you actually don't know that they actually do drive public markets and even public market returns as well. It's something that's typically associated with venture, but it's also the same thing with public as well, right? Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, you have an entire ocean, which is the entire listed universe of listed companies, right? I think what we're trying here is to really fish and to try to get a very small pond. And it's this very small pond of companies that we typically look at. And if you are fishing it right, you should be at most looking at most a couple of hundred of companies, that's all. And the entire investing universe. You could be refreshing as you have new companies that are coming in and out. But generally, you should not be looking at like thousands or even 10,000 of companies, because if you're fishing right, I think that's most importantly. And I think the power loss is such an important concept. And once you figure out this, you know exactly where to zoom in and you try to refine your own investment criteria, which is what I've continuously tried to do and try to get it right. So I think the most importantly, get the framework right. Find these winners only in such a small pond of the entire ocean. Get it right, and hopefully your probabilities of success should be higher.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point that when you talk about the returns, you're thinking, let's say that all of US equities were worth $1 million in 1926. I don't know if it's true, probably not. And they're worth $1 billion today, right? And you're talking, I'm just throwing out numbers out there, but that increase in value from a million to a billion, if we took it as a whole, ocean, it's just a portion of stocks that really lasted long enough. I think that's the key element, that had profitable years after years and could grow and succeed and outsmart competition for decades to be able to become much bigger, well-established companies. And not just big for the sake of being big, but big with profits. And something to think about, because it quickly eliminates a lot of ideas out there. And it makes your life a lot easier. So I see this as a glass half full when you think about it. I don't have to own one of everything, you know, the Noah's Ark investing. No, I could actually own a handful. And when I say handful, whatever you're comfortable with, 20, 50, 100, whatever it is for you that you feel comfortable. But it's a much smaller pond and it's a much smaller group of companies that you really need to own. You make another interesting point that is a revelation to a lot of investors, which is that you could forget recessions, you could forget predictions, and you could just focus on the long run. And the media and even the financial newspapers and TV focus on predictions. Everybody wants to guess up or down, interest rates up and down. You say ignore all of it. And it's music to my ears, but tell me more about that.
I think there are always going to be recessions. There are always going to be sales, and everyone's going to be making predictions, right? I think when I'm not in the business of making macroeconomic predictions, and I think trying to time it perfectly just to try to make an additional couple percentages of returns just doesn't make sense, because when I try to do it, I might end up missing the best days. And once you miss the best days, your returns significantly fall. But it's not about missing the worst days, because when the stock market goes up, it's not about missing the worst days. It's about missing the best days. Right. And I think if I think about it, there are actually very few professional forecasters that have just gotten any prediction of interest rates, inflations, or even recessions right consistently over long periods of time, right? I think that's the bit, consistently over long periods of time. And that's so difficult. Why do I even bother, right? I think trying to time it perfectly over the long run just costs so much more than trying to time it perfectly, right? Mm-hmm. I think the way to think about it is this. With respect to market declines, as investors, we have to be so comfortable with market declines, because a very interesting fact which I did in the study is that this, almost 93% of the time, markets are below all-time highs. So if markets are below all-time high, you've got to be just very comfortable that down actually, right? And 93% of the time, you are down from all-time highs. If you can't even,
that's a good point.
If you can't even take that, you know, you should not be investing, right? And once you come into that realization that market declines, it's a feature, right? They tend to decline about 10% every 1 year, 20% every 3 to 5 years, 30 to 40% every 10 to 20 years, right? Once you know that frequency, you know that it keeps happening, you then custom your mindset to think about, okay, declines are really normal, and when they come, and they actually come very quickly, you need to be able to be ready to take advantage of it. And once you get that right, it's just such a bit. And I think once you know that, just know how often market will fall, how much they will fall, and know that it's common and part and parcel of investing. I think that's just so powerful. And I think just get your mind to frame that volatility in this case, which is price volatility, it's really just normal.
The other point that you make that has a lot to do with what you just mentioned is that market sell-offs are buying opportunities. And I would list this principle right after the one that stocks are small pieces of businesses. If you get those two, I think you're already halfway there, if not more. So if you can see that the sell-off is a buying opportunity, it changes everything. And you touched on something really interesting. I call it that we take the escalator or the stairs on the way up, and then we take the elevator down. So in 2020, in March of 2020, in US equities, 3 years of gains, 3 years of gains were lost in 3 weeks. That was a buying opportunity. But when you think about it, how quickly those things happen, that's when people freeze and panic and fear takes over. But you say it's a buying opportunity. Tell me more about that.
I think the way to think about it is a buying opportunity, we always got to go back to the business, right? If the businesses themselves are doing well, and if they continue to grow revenues and profits, and for example, you look at 2020, right? There's so many businesses that continue to do so well and grow. Let's not name specific companies, but I think if you do that, and if you actually follow the business narrative, not the price narrative, of which the prices actually fall, you keep buying to those businesses, you'll be perfectly fine. And I think that's the biggest revelation back in 2020. Now, I think fast forward, obviously, into 2021, everybody got too excited back in 2020 and prices became all-time high. So one could argue that valuations were really all-time high. And unfortunately, as investors, I can't sell my entire portfolio, which is more than 60 holdings, and try to rotate 60 in and 60 out and 60 in back again at the lows, right? And try to do that, trying to make 120 investing decisions. I'm gonna make something wrong at that point of time, right? It's not something that I can unfortunately do all the time, and I don't seek to do that. But I think the way to put it this way, the typical value of the portfolio tends to grow around, so the revenues tend to grow around 30 to 35% CAGR for the portfolio. Free cash flow margins also tend to grow around that region. I don't know that my intrinsic value of the portfolio grew by that. So if a stock market, for example, were to went up by 100%, I would know that it would be gone up much more than the intrinsic value that it should typically grow on average over the long run. Right. And then, of course, we had last year where the stock market was down 30%. So it's actually more really normalizing. If you think about it, if actually 2021 and 2020 didn't happen and 2021 didn't happen, the portfolio would have gone up quite normally over the long period of time. And I think that was just the biggest way to think about it. So when you think about sell-offs, right, try to figure out what is the business narrative, and if the business is doing fine, I often just continue to keep buying, and especially try to maintain a list of high conviction and million conviction companies and to keep doing for that point. I think the toughest bit, to be honest, is selling. We try to really make as few selling decisions as possible. But when companies don't do too well, you have to, I guess it's a structural bit, right? When they do it, not just one quarter, a couple of quarters, right? And you see more competition, you see the margins declining, you see poorer investment or reinvestment opportunities, you see growth deceleration very rapidly. Those are not just things that happen over a quarter. You need to let them run over a couple of quarters just to confirm that. So that I am quite patient with the companies generally. I always let them run through a couple of quarters before I get any sense, before I finally exit them. So that's the bit. I think that's the very key differentiating point, and always to keep buying. And the best way I like to think about it is this quote that I had. Find excellence, buy excellence, hold excellence, and keep adding to excellence and sell mediocrity. Mm-hmm. I think that's how you invest. And you keep doing that really. That really just allows you to do it and keep doing it, especially through market drawdowns, right? The best way to think about it is this. If you have a company that is growing, say, revenues 20-25%, right? Their PE, their normalized PEs and their profit margins are, say, 20-20%. They're growing revenues about 25%. Their net income margins are probably 25%, right? So very profitable company, and very few companies are like that. Their PE normally trades between 30-50, and suddenly the PE falls to 15, right? The business continues to grow. Nothing else changes. You should be so happy and so elated at the opportunity that you could be exactly buying and owning this company for the first time at such good valuations. I think that has dramatically changed in terms of the way I thought about it, especially in terms of price. I think the most important thing about price is what Karl Marx likes to think, right? Is that when something is overvalued, prospective returns are low and risk and the margin of safety is actually low, which means there's a high risk.
Yeah.
When valuations are low, your margin of safety is actually very high because there's actually it can go down much more, because if it go down much more, it just becomes screamingly cheap. And prospective returns actually look much more attractive or look. And once you come and frame that valuation versus price coming from that standpoint, it matters so much. But I think just now going back to that concept that you came across, right, which is if companies can keep growing and keep reinvesting and are profitable for long periods of time, which is really durability, and if durability is so powerful, this price also becomes a smaller aspect, right? Because then the durability of growth becomes a much more bigger factor in the overall returns and scheme of things versus price. So I think price matters a lot, especially if it's for shorter horizons, but price matters less if a company keeps growing 25% CAGR for 20 years. If you try to buy something 10%, 20% cheaper, really doesn't matter if that thing is going to be a 20 bagger, right?
So you're touching on the next question that I have for you, which is timing. And a lot of investors obsess about timing. And I get those questions, is this a good time? And I always tell people, now is always the best time, because I see it as a lifelong pursuit. So you have to start as soon as you possibly can and then just keep at it. But you show three examples, one investor that buys at a high for the year, one at a low for the year, and one at the same time of the year. And then you show that the results don't really differ that much. Can you talk about that study, which would imply that we can forget about market timing?
This is such a great question. I think the example that I had was three siblings. They're basically investing $10,000 a year in global stocks for 40 years from 1977. So we have three siblings. The first sibling is Jane, who's a perfect market timer. Every year, that $10,000, she will invest the market low for the year. We have the second sibling, which is Jack, who does not time the market, just invest at the first day of the year. And we have John, the third sibling, which is a poor market timer, invest at the high of each year. How bad can he possibly get, right? The most funny thing is that after 40 years, this is the arcade, which is compounded annual growth returns. Jane, with the perfect timing, the first sibling, gets 9.3%. Jack, with no timing, gets 9.1%. 0.2% different. And John, who is a poor market timer, the low, the ones who always invest at the high of each year, gets only 8.8. So you look at 9.3, 9.1, and 8.8, right? And if you look at that number overall in terms of that number, the sibling with the perfect timing ends up with 4.35 million. Jack with no timing ends up with 4.11 million. Okay, 200,000 lesser. Right. And John with poor timing ends up with 3.6 million. Half a million lower. But it's between $3 to $4 million, right? I mean, the way I think is very instructive is this. You can try to get the best timing, But really, what you're trying to just squeeze out is there's just a couple of basis points. And if you miss anything else, it becomes even worse. And I think generally what I try to do, to be honest, as you realize, as our portfolios start becoming bigger, right? The incremental amount of money, you try to keep timing, even grabbing the most perfect time, it really doesn't incremental returns overall to the overall portfolio returns. I think when you start to realize that as us, even as portfolio allocators, that is just so hilarious. And you realize that the best way is just to basically just not time the market at all. You can try to time the market, but you realize that actually after a while, it's just a fool's error.
I think the lesson here is it pays to participate even if you don't time it perfectly. I think obsessing about the timing can take you away from the market. And as you mentioned, the best days are the ones that you don't want to miss out on. And even if you do poorly in terms of timing, as the three examples that you showed, you'll still do better than if you waited it out and not participated at all, which would be really sad to think about that 40 years with no participation at all. So it shouldn't keep you out of the market. I thought it was a really interesting point. You know that I had financial independence experts on the show, and they were making a point of how to reach financial independence, that you don't have to be a millionaire or make millions each year to reach financial independence. They explain the numbers and how they work. And in your book, it's one of the themes that you mentioned, that becoming a millionaire is not necessarily related to the income you earn. That's one point you make. And then you say becoming a millionaire doesn't require luck. Two big statements. So tell me more about it. And one of the goals of investing is to reach a certain level of comfort and maybe financial independence, in the sense that you could choose not to work ever again. But tell me about those two ideas that you share in the book.
I think those are just such very important ideas. And I think the best way to think about it is think about games of luck versus games of skill, right? And if the most important thing, if a game is a game of skill game, if you can lose intentionally, that's something that is shared by Michael Morbison in mm-hmm. The Success Equation. If you can think about it, a game of chess is a pure skill game at best, right? Which you can intentionally lose, because if you make a wrong move, you can intentionally make a wrong move and you can lose a king or a queen, or you can lose the game. Whereas on the opposite spectrum, right, you have a game of roulette or jackpot, and that's almost pure luck. And The way to think about it, and going back into investing, is that if you're investing in the short term, you're actually highly dependent on luck. If I'm buying and trading companies, there's so much noise, you have a 52% choice chance of winning. The probability of winning is just on average slightly better than a coin toss, right? There's very little you can do to be more right than others. And when you're doing it in such a way, luck becomes a much larger role. But if you do it over the long term, right, and as I shared, the whole book and the whole investing approach is really try to just make sure the probabilities of success and chance of winning skews in your favor. And if you do that, actually, yes, luck still matters, but luck matters significantly lesser. I think that's the way to do it. So coming back to financial independence, right, if you do it through investing, yes, if you do it for a very short term, you know, you're going to depend on luck. But if you do it for a very long term, luck becomes just a much smaller role. And I think the best way to think about it is that saying that get the process right, because it matters so much more. This is my four favorite words, which I love to do this, is this. The way to get financial independence is this. Earn more, spend less, save more, and invest well. That is so simple, right? That's it, right? All of that. That is just the path to financial freedom. So to give you an example, right? If one starts by investing $10,000 today and $500 every month at 10% compounded returns, after 30 years, one gets to $1.3 million, right? Mm-hmm. You can be a millionaire in 30 years. But the problem is that, I guess, it's really not that difficult. But how many people want to actually do that? Everybody wants to get rich quick, when it's truly not about getting rich quick. A way of investing, there are certain markets that just skews in your favor. All you need to do is just keep doing it. Don't time the market. Keep going inconsistently and get it. And you will get there eventually.
It's pretty remarkable. And there are those stories that make a point. I think New York Times 30 years ago or so ran a story of a UPS driver, a truck driver, that lived a very simple and frugal life and invested everything he could with a very limited salary. And he ended up with millions of dollars. I thought it was tens of millions. I would have to look up the article that he gave away to various institutions and charities and lived a long life, which also helps with compounding. But when you think about it, the idea that you don't have to be making millions each year to reach a millionaire level of wealth, I think it's very eye-opening, and the idea that it doesn't require luck. It's more of a process that you set up and you repeat year after year, and the results will follow. It's very easy to present. It's a simple idea, but I think it's one of the hardest things to truly embrace and accept and follow. So I think that's the hard part. But isn't it with a lot of truths in life that the principle is very simple, but embracing it, it's very hard. I want to ask you about the kinds of companies that you invest in. So you have Titans, Proven Winners, Emerging Stars, and Moonshots. I like the names. I like the labels. Tell me what's behind them. What kind of companies, and you don't have to mention specific companies, but just to give us an idea, what kind of companies belong to those different groups and why do they belong in your portfolio?
Yeah, so I think the way to think about it is the way I invest is try to find quality compounders and companies that are profitable, but eventually most, their end goal, they have to be profitable, but they can be rapid, not profitable, but going to profitability over very quickly over the very long run. So the way I try to do it is try to find through these four types of companies. And the first one is Titans. I call them, they tend to be very large, unstoppable businesses that, despite their size, tend to be maybe say $100 billion market cap and above. They still continue to be leading the way, shaping the future. They tend to have lots of resources at their disposal. Some might be already be paying some dividends or doing a fair bit of share buybacks. But they tend to have very rock solid financials. They also know, they tend to be very highly competitive from that aspect as well. So the risk also tends to be much lower. I guess the biggest fear is around whether can they still become bigger. But I think most of them can continue to keep growing and be on a hunt for such ambitious companies. The second one I would say is Proven Winners, meaning a step down from these titans, right? So I think they tend to be leading large and growing industries. So they're more niche in their standpoint, but they're still slowly shaping the world because they're evolving, they're getting up there. So they tend to be smaller than the titans, but they still possess many of the traits that we look for in good businesses. They have some sort of proven track record already, some sort of strong competitive advantages, compelling business units, business models, and growth potential, but they tend to be still not a large percentage of their overall total addressable market, so they can continue to keep growing and still have a fair bit of outperformance. The third one, it's basically emerging stars. It's what I tend to like the best. A lot of them have already tend to have some early traction. They are already starting to grow or tend to be disruptors in those markets. The risk can be a bit higher because some of them can be quite larger and unproven. But because of the amount of value that they're creating and the amount of revenues, and they tend to be really profitable, this tend to be the multi-bagger segment. And because of this, the asymmetric payoffs tend to be the highest. And this is also what some of my biggest holdings have been traditionally been in this space in the emerging stars. The fourth one is what I call moonshots. So moonshots are much smaller companies that I would say they are grow at probably much at much more earlier stages of the disrupting phase. They're growing very rapidly. They might not, or most often are not profitable, but are rapidly improving their profitability as a result. They have shown not necessarily the top dog yet, but they tend to be are growing rapidly and improving. So they're showing good strengths on that phase. This one, the accuracy tends to be lower because it's just harder to tell generally. But if you can get it right, one of these can significantly return the entire portfolio. So, but the way to think about it is again, back to allocation, right? So I think for moonshots, the allocations tend to be smaller just because of the risks. But also because if they become bigger, if they start becoming emerging stars, you can always keep adding to them. So that's what I always do, which is try to add to the winners. So I think the best ones have always been emerging stars as they grow towards proven winners and titans.
Yeah, I love that you find something across all sizes. So you're not just focusing on the big or the small. I think it's really interesting because they all can play a role in the portfolio. So when I think of a portfolio, I think of a collection of businesses and they all will make some contribution. And it's good to be aware that you have very different expectations if it's a mature, big business, number one, and especially with a market cap of really big size, you can't expect this company to go up 100 times anymore. The earth is too small for this company to go and become much bigger. I think that's the idea. But then the smaller companies, they might be already established, already recognized, but they could become much bigger. So knowing and having the right expectations towards various investments within your portfolio, I think it's a very healthy way of looking. I like to talk about selling. And one specific aspect that you mentioned in your book that I really paused and thought about, you write to never sell entirely. If you love learning, why ever sell a position entirely? And I paused and I thought about it. And then you mentioned Steve Jobs. People might have forgotten, but Steve Jobs was fired from Apple, only to come back much later and give us iPhone and iPad and gave Apple really a second license on life. Like it really reinvented the company and brought it back. And it is what it is today because of the second arrival of Steve Jobs. But the one interesting point that you mentioned is that he chose not to sell, even though he was fired, and he held on to a share. Tell me more about this idea, because once we put in all the research and the work, there's a time when we want to sell for various reasons, and I'm always tempted to leave something behind because I can be still positively surprised by something that I have not recognized at that point just yet. Tell me about this idea, never sell entirely. I haven't heard that before, and I like it. So tell me more about that.
This is a very interesting concept. I think when I first started, I wanted to hold it. If you can sense from my style of investing, it looks like this, right? When we're searching for multi-baggers, really a little is all. If something is going to be a winner and a multi-bagger, a little is all you need. And if it's not going to be, a little is all you want, right? So if you can think about it, the best thing is if you let your winners run really high, the winners become a significant portion of the portfolio. The losers become a negligible portion. So even if they're there, they're still around, they're not really going to matter, right? So I think the way to think about it is ultimately going back to the business. If the business is doing actually fairly well, is doing still fine, and the market is just indiscriminately selling it or just getting it out of favor, I actually choose to keep it around. And that, to be honest, there have been many, many times that has happened over the last couple of years, and I still just kept a lot of these companies around because they're totally perfectly fine. I'm not going to add that because there's just a bit of fuzzy around it, but I've kept that. And you know what's the most funny thing? Some of them have become 5, 10, 15 baggers.
Still.
That's how amazing, right? That you realize and you just decided, no, that's perfectly nothing fine. There's nothing wrong with it, right? But it's just that the market is just very indiscriminately and just very negative around it. There's so many examples. But I think the way to think about it is, but if the business is structurally declining, I would not hesitate to exit the position entirely because I think in investing is this, right? The way we're connecting businesses, I know Buffett has a very different aspect to it, right? He had some of the textile industries and even though they were declining, he still kept a lot of the textile industries because they were employing people. But I think for us, we are stewards of capital and it's important that we make sure that our stewards of capital best reflects our allocation as well, right? I think a lot of the companies, if they are still growing, most importantly, we should still keep them. But if they're structurally declining, we should not hesitate to exit the entire position. I think that's the style of investing. So you can think about it, just because of this style, the losers become such a small percentage. And my turnover generally has been very low. In 2021, my turnover was 2%. In 2022, my turnover was 8%. If you compare to the industry average, it's around 60%, right? So even though, I think last year was extremely high because I wanted to pare down to a lower set of companies overall from that standpoint. So I would expect turnover to be significantly lower actually in the low single digits generally from that standpoint. So I think by that nature, if something doesn't pique your interest, if the business is not doing well, and if it just pains you to keep reviewing that business, sell that position, exit the entire position. But if the business is doing perfectly fine, keep it. And sometimes you never know.
There are some positive surprises. Never sell all of it. That's especially the reason still to like it. I like to wrap up these conversations with a definition of success. I have a feeling where you're going to go with that, but still I'm going to ask. Eugene, what's your definition of success?
I think success for me really sums it back to Ikigai, which I shared at the beginning. It's really being able to do every day what I love, what the world needs, what I'm good at, and hopefully what I can be paid for. And I think for me, that's investing. For me, if I can keep doing this for my own capital, being stewards of capital for my own future investing partners, being able to just live and breathe the world investing without a noise, that would be truly something that I can keep doing day in and day out until as old as I could hopefully be into my 80s and to my 90s, for which my body and mind allows me to. I think this allows me to just keep giving back, teaching, helping people to invest more by sharing my knowledge. I might not be able to help everyone, and that's going to be the unfortunate truth. But if you can help a few, change their lives, right? You can impact generations. The most powerful bit is that through just us as a collective force, we are investing in companies that really make sense, that really is impacting and changing the world for the better, which is really what Envision Investing is about, we can come back and become a very powerful collective force of good, right? And I think that's better than what even like ECG or anything like that at all. I mean, it's really just that do it right, do it well. We can impact generations, and we through ourselves, hopefully these companies can also help us and compound our wealth dramatically. I think that's what I just seek to day in and day out.
Beautifully put. Well, Eugene, thank you so much. I highly recommend your book, Vision Investing, How We Beat Wall Street, and you can too. It's full of research and studies and great arguments in favor of long-term patient investing. And it also shares your personal story that's very relatable. And I told you, I'm very curious about why people do what they do. And I think your book shows why you're passionate about investing, or passionate about sharing what you've learned while investing, and how the investments that you make can make a positive impact in the world. And you're having fun doing it, I can tell. So it makes me happy. Thank you, Eugene.
Thank you so much, Bogumi, for having me.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Seacard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Seacard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents, available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.